Welcome everybody. It's February 5th, 2022. Tonight is the seventh lecture of this year, the history of Poland. And tonight we are finally going to be getting to Chmielnicki's uprising. This is what we know it as Gzeiras Tach V'Tat. Tach V'Tat is the Hebrew dates of 1648 and 1649. Was Tach is 48 and Tach Tat is 49. So we know it as Gzeiras Tach V'Tat, and it was the start of a terrible time for the Jews in Europe, in Poland. Up until that time, Harvey, just up until that time, we spent the last 2 weeks showing the greatness of Poland in terms of its Torah, in terms of its riches, and it was just idyllic. The lands, it was just the perfect for the Jewish people. The government was very accepting. The people were accepting. The opportunity for the Jews were amazing. For about 150 years, even more, but for 150 years, there was a major Jewish community there, and it just grew and it flourished in all ways. We said in the middle 1500s, it already started to become the leader of Jewish scholarship. Now, there was a center of Jewish scholarship really moved to Poland. And last week we spoke about some of the amazing personalities that was in Poland, both in terms of learning Gemara. And it was the Gemara has like a certain progression. You know, first came Gemara, and then after the Gemara the Gaonim. But in terms of Ashkenazic Jewry, you had Rashi. And then after Rashi's Perish, you had about 200, 250 years of Tosfos. And now in Poland was the Mefarshim on Tosfos. There is the, I grew up and all my Rebbeim said, and this is what is, this is what they say, is you can't really understand Tosfos without the Marshal, the Maram, the Marshal, which is in the back of the Gemara after Tosfos. And this was all, These Mefarshim were written all during this time. At the same time, we mentioned Halacha was being developed. You know, it was this was the time it started. You know, with the Beis Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Cairo, who was in Asia Minor, and then he moved to Eretz Yisrael to Sfat, and then when his Sefer came to Europe, it was the Ramah. Rav Moshe Isserles, he edited it, so to speak. He added glosses to it. And then for the next 100 years or so, 150 years, the Gedolim in Europe just kept adding and adding and adding. So today, we have the Torah Shulchan Aruch and the Shulchan Aruch. Most of those Mefarshim were all developed from this era. Okay, and halacha continues to this day. It keeps, evolving.
At this time, what happened to the scholars in Eretz Yisrael? Were they there? Or
yeah,
they,
no, they were there. It was scholarship was,
so they,
yes.
They developed their own.
That was correct. The Sephardim developed their own. Nothing like the Ashkenazim there. Okay, they did develop in a different way. They didn't have, Tosfos wasn't, part and parcel of their, of their learning. They had Tosfos, just like we have other Rishonim. We had the Ramban and the Rashba and the Ritva and the Meiri. We have all these other Rishonim, and they had Tosfos also. But the learning of Tosfos, the developing of Tosfos led to a different type of learning. And then we also mentioned that Poland in particular, they were into this pilpulistic type of a learning, something which we just borrow a little bit from, but we don't have exactly what it was, but it was very popular. And it brought people into the yeshivas and got everybody excited. And like we mentioned last time, every community, was all filled with learning. And then this is going to be the beginning of the end. So starting with this uprising in 1648, for the next 10 years, the first 2 years are going to be the worst for the Jewish people. But for 10 years, Poland is going to be involved in wars, first with the Cossacks, with the Chmielnicki, and the Cossacks and the Tartars. And then Sweden is going to get involved, and then Russia is going to get involved, and Moldavia is going to get involved, and then other foreign powers are going to get involved. And for 10 years, the entire Poland is going to be uprooted with war, and war led to diseases, plagues, and it's just going to be a mess. And at the end of it all, there's still, Poland will probably, it will be still the largest community of Jews. The center of Jewish scholarship will still be in Poland, but not like it was before. There's going to be tremendous amount of poverty, and there's going to be other places that will have developed in terms of learning, because hundreds of thousands of Jews will have been killed and will have left Poland. So Poland is going to be a shadow of itself after these 10 years. So what I'd like to do is let's first start with how did this uprising happen? So one of the things that uprising first happened is there happened to have been a king, Władysław, if I'm saying his name right, I can't remember, and Jagiello, and he was the king of Poland, and he married Jadwiga, who was the daughter of Louis I of Hungary, and she was the Grand Duchess. She was the Grand Duchess of Lithuania. And what happened is when they got married, so then it became the Polish-Lithuania Commonwealth, because you had a king and the queen were both the rulers of Poland and Lithuania. So it was they were the same types of people. I don't think there was any in terms of, you know, wars between them. But now they had, you know, different countries merging, you know, so they had to now, you know, deal with each other. What's the, you know, what are the nobles in Lithuania? What are their rights in terms of the nobles in Poland? Are we all now going to be under the Polish king? Or no, we're going to have two separate countries ruled by the same ruler. And that's basically really what it ended up, is you had two countries under the same ruler. The king of Poland was the king of it all, but they created a position called the Grand Duchess or the Grand Duke of Lithuania. So you had, and they pretty much worked together, but you could always imagine like the rights of one as opposed to the rights of the other, and they all had to get along, and which they really did. Now, where it really came to a head is about almost 170 years later or so, 80 years later, in 1569. So there was something called the Union of Lublin, and this Union of Lublin was some sort of a charter that defined the rights and rules and the relationship between the two countries. Well, I guess what was one of the things that was happening until that time is, first of all, I'll just show you a map how Lithuania's lands was much larger than Poland's lands, but Lithuania was constantly being threatened and attacked by Russia. Lithuania wasn't strong enough. They felt they were always on the losing side. And one of the main things is that they needed help from Poland. And Poland kept sending money and whatever, but at some point, like, you know, people in Poland said, this doesn't make sense. Yet they knew if Lithuania would fall, then Poland would fall.
Right.
So one thing they did is they came up with the Union of Lublin, some sort of charter constitution, I don't know how you would define it, and they came up with a number of things that happened because of this charter. And one of the things, it was a land change. that many land was transferred from, you'll see in a second, from Lithuania to Poland. So they're going to end up with a lot of land. And that land is going to be where the Cossack Rebellion, the Tafutat is going to, it's all going to start from there. That's one main thing. Another thing that happened as a result of this was the, and it's going to, and this is, in the beginning it may have worked great, but at the end this is going to be the destruction of Poland. Poland is going to lose everything because of this, and that is that the Polish, the nobles, ended up getting a lot more rights out of all of this than the king. And at after this, it was the king, Sigismund, who was the lad, he did not have any children. So he realized afterwards, you know, I guess he wanted to keep some sort of legacy for himself, so he was very, very much pushing for this union to take place. And after him, the monarch, the kingship was voted on, okay, which gave the nobles a lot more power than they had before. And eventually what's going to happen is it's going to happen with Khmelnytsky is that these Poles, the king is going to die. There's not going to be another king. All the nobles are not, you know, they have, I guess you would say, too much power, and they don't react quick enough towards the danger. Eventually what's going to happen is that the entire monarch is going to be bought off by some foreign country, and eventually in the end of the 1780s, 1790s, Poland is going to cease to exist. And that kind of, it's going to come back after World War I when they build up these artificial countries, but it's going to be taken over. Another thing that really happened with the Jews, let me just see if I missed something over here, is that another thing which really happened with the Jews is that up until now, mainly it was the king that had more power, and the king and the Jews really were working for the king, the royal. And if your kings are working, and if the Jews are working for the king, you usually would find the Jews in the main cities where the royal king had more control. Where, and that's, you know, they were, when I say working for the king, means that they were really under the royal protection. With the Union of Lublin, it gave the nobles more power. So now instead, the nobles, all of a sudden, they themselves started hiring Jews to run their estates. They had more autonomy and they had more power and they were able to do more, and they needed more Jews. So what would then happen, and this is the time that the Jews started to move to the countryside, to the nobles, and they started to move all over. And now you started to have Jews coming into the shtetl and these little areas as opposed to being centralized in the big cities. And you also had, at this point, I don't know how much of a big issue it was, but you had you'll have the Jews royal working for the royal monarch, you know, versus Jews working for the nobles, which may have been at odds, you know. Wasn't that there was like an actual war, the dukes, the nobles didn't go to war against the king, but they're definitely different interests, different were involved. The nobles wanted one thing as opposed to they wanted the other. And that's what was happening. So again, within 100 years, okay, so as a result of all this, part of the deal was that the Poland annexes a lot of land from Lithuania. So if you look over here, the yellow, this is Lithuania, and I guess the white or the off-white, this is Poland. And as a result, this would be like in 1526, but in 1569, as a result of this, the map looked like this.
Wow.
So you see that the entire southeast area was transferred from Lithuania to Poland. Now, this area here, okay, let me just see what this area is. So this area here was more like, I don't know if you would say, well, I guess I would understand it as like the Wild West, you know, like, you know, when the United States was here, the Wild West, there was more lawlessness, less less, you know, governors and less police or marshals or whatever. And as you went to the West here in the United States until they all developed, it was like, you know, like a free-for-all. And that was sort of what was going on over here in the late 1500s all the way into the 1600s. You would have, like, people, the nobles were trying to, like, make land grabs. This, I don't exactly know how it would have happened, but nobles were trying to get land, and they were trying to take from the Ukrainians or the people that were living here. They were trying to take advantage of them. They had farms and everything, and up until this time, they were definitely not under the Polish nobles. And at this point, now that the Polish nobles were there, they started to try to take more land and definitely take advantage of the Ukrainians that were there. Okay, so the Ukrainians were, like, really pushed down as a result of this. And a few other things that happened here is that down here, this purple, if you see the purple on the bottom of the map, this is the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire at the time was in its height. And it was, like, massive. It went all the way down into Asia Minor, all the way down into the Middle East, all the way down into Egypt. And then it swung around to Africa, all of North Africa, but a large part of North Africa. In history, the Ottoman Empire was, in terms of land mass, one of the largest empires in history. It had a tremendous amount of land. So there was always problems. Now, this was Muslim area. Everything else here was Christian. So you had Moldavia, this would have been Moldavia, Transylvania, Austria, the Habsburg Empire, which was Austria. Eventually this all became Austria-Hungary. But at this time, this is the way it was broken down. And what they had over here were Muslims and Christians. And over here, this area always had issues with the Muslims, or they were the Tartars. They were called the Tartars. Had they come to be Tartars originally, this goes back from Genghis Khan, when they conquered Genghis Khan. That was probably the greatest in terms of landmass ever. They started in China, and they worked all the way to here. They, you know, and they had these different clans, and eventually that broke up into different areas. And you had people over here that were Muslim, and they were known as Tartars, okay? And they always would raid into this area here, and they would raid for food and steal money and say, you know, whatever, that's what, you know, I guess, like the quote Reagan, boys will be boys, you know? They just, yes?
Where is Lunga on the map?
Where is?
Lunga.
I'm not sure.
Border with Russia,
then it would be somewhere here. Now these borders are going to change. I mean, this today is Ukraine, okay? So Lumjo problem. I'm not sure. I have to look for it here. Maybe we'll have other maps. I do have other maps that are better. But this is what I. Okay.
What about
Brest or Tok? Oh, here, Brest Litovsk this is Brist. Would be right here. Okay. So Brist remains in Lithuania. Lithuania had four big cities. One of them was Brisk. One of them was,
was it the one that was short to Brisk?
Yeah, it is Brisk. Okay. So what happened is in order to stop the raids, what the Polish government did is they hired these Ukrainians, and they called them Cossacks, and they hired 30,000 of them. They gave them arms, they gave them whatever, and their job was to protect the southern border down here. And there were 30,000 of them. They didn't have to pay taxes. Okay, so they had exempting taxes, and part of you not paying taxes is you are protecting the Southern Empire, the Southern Polish Empire. Okay, that was the deal. Now, I don't have, maybe I should have put up here, but during these times, in the early 1600s, there were two Cossack rebellions that were put down. And every time they put down the Cossack rebellions, again, the Cossacks were treated terribly, even worse than Jews. But the nobles actually asked a lot of Jews to move in this area in order to help them run the area, in order to collect taxes and to have taverns and, you know, the liquor. The Jews, you know, they didn't drink the liquor themselves, but it was, you know, the Ukrainians and Polish, they would drink their miseries away. It was a big money maker. So, but they did send a lot of Jews in this area to help them, you know, run the area, steal the money from the Ukrainians. But that's what they did. So the Ukrainians rebelled twice. The first time they rebelled, they were put down by the Polish army, and they removed from 30,000 Cossacks that were working for the crown, that they lowered it to, I believe, 18,000. So now there was only 18,000, and then about another 20 years later, they rebelled again, and they got it from 18,000, I'm not sure, to either 12 or 6,000. And those, after that time, those Cossacks were really under Polish generals or the Polish army. In other words, instead of working for them, you know, controlling themselves and having their own hierarchy, Hitman, I think they were called, and they were having their own, but they were now under the Polish. Okay, and now we're coming into 1648. Now this is, again, a very broad general idea of what's going on. That's what's going on here. A lot of what I'm saying, first of all, I got from Rabbi Irons. He gives he gives lectures on these, and he quotes from this book called Yavei Metzula. And that was written by Rav Nassim Nata Hanover, who was in Podolia. We'll see a little bit of his story. He was in this area, and he fled for his life. He ended up in Hanover in Germany. I think he remained there. He didn't come back. But he wrote about what happened. So a lot of the information from our side comes from Rav Nassim Nata. So he writes... another thing that Sigismund did, he writes very kindly of the Polish kings, was a kind, upright man, loved peace. But one of the things he did is that, again, the Ukrainians were Greek Orthodox Christians, as opposed to Western or as opposed to Christians. They were a different type, and Catholics. And what Sigismund did, he raised the status of the Catholic dukes and princes above the Greek Orthodox. So now some of the nobles and dukes that were in Ukraine at the time wanted the advantages, whatever they were, of being part of the Catholic Church as opposed to the Greek Orthodox Church. So they turned. They said, all right, we're going to be Catholic now. Meanwhile, the Hamonam, the people were more Greek Orthodox. And some of the nobles that were with them now felt more connected to the Polish crown, if nothing else, that they get more money or privileges or rights or whatever it was. That was another thing that also was playing, going on here. Okay, and so he writes, this is all from Nassim Nata, he writes that these people were so inferior that they became slaves and handmaids of the Polish people and of the Jews. Those among them who were trained, they became these Cossacks. Originally, there were 30,000 of them. They were exempt from taxes, and they were supposed to guard the frontier between the Tartars and, I guess, Little Russia again, south that area. Cossacks, Tartars. Okay. Okay. Now, this was okay. So now there was a. There was a few things that went on here, and I don't have this story. Okay, again, this is just another type of a map. You get to see it more in a different area. This is the Ukraine. Oh yeah, I wanted to just show one thing. You see where Kiev is, right?
Right.
So So this is the Dnieper River. It's, there's a D in front of it. I don't know how you say it. Do you say Dnieper? So this is where, this is the area that we're talking about, both east of the Dnieper and the west. On the east of the Dnieper River, yes, there were nobles, but it was really the Wild West. I mean, any people that were, you know, the Polish crown is like this, you know, I guess south side of Chicago. You know, you were you went to the no-fly zone, or not the no-fly zone, but you went to certain areas that was really dangerous. They had much less control in those areas than west of the Dnieper River, and that's also going to be important because, you know, Khmelnytsky is going to run away. He's going to run away to the other side. He's going to find a lot of support on this side. Here again is the Ottoman Empire, Hungary, which is Transylvania, Austria, Moldavia, this should be here. Okay, anyway, this is another way of the map. Sweden is going to get into the game, and they're going to attack from the north. Russia is going to attack from the east, and the Ottomans are going to attack from the south. It's just, at one point, there's nothing left except the small little thing of Poland, and until they work their way back. Okay, so there was the person by this name of Khmelnytsky. He was a Cossack, and he was sort of a noble. He was a rich person, and he is described, he was one of the officers of the hundreds of the Cossacks. He was very rich, a lot of sheep and ox, and he was an evil genius, a man of sinister designs and fierce warrior. This is how Nassim Nathan describes him. He lived in Shemirin, if I'm saying it right, under the rule of General Poniatowski. Again, during this time, the Polish were over the Cossacks. You know, they didn't trust them anymore. They rebelled twice, so they took away a lot of their privileges. General was aware of this man and his manner of speech. He was soft-spoken, but he had evil in his heart. At first, he appeared to Jews as friends, speak to them pleasant. But they lie with their tongues and deceitful. This is how Nassim Nathan describes him. Okay, there are two basic stories on what happened with Khmelnytsky. Both of them, it really seems that he was taken advantage of. One of them was where there was this other noble that was basically jealous of him and basically just raided his land and took a lot of his sheep and cattle. And in one of the raids, it actually, they either injured or killed his son, you know, badly beaten. And, like, he was, you know, this is what they did to him. And he tried to get justice. And he would go to some of the nobles, and he actually tried to make his way to the king and try to tell the king, this is what, look what they did to me here. And either he writes over here that the king was either unwilling or powerless to help him. There's another story also that he was engaged to some lady, and some, again, another Polish, I don't know if it's the same one, or some Polish basically stole her away from him. So he was not, he lost it. The story continues that he didn't get revenge right away. But he waited and waited. And what happened is this general, this king or the governor with the general decided one time to raid the Tartars. Like, you know, let's go raid the Tartars and we'll take some booty from them and come back. So Khmelnytsky heard about this, knew they were going. And Khmelnytsky sent a message to the Tartars that they're going to be raided by this noble who stole a lot of his stuff and killed his son and everything. So this noble with his army went into the Tartar area, expecting, you know, like nothing, a little just to get in. They were met by a superior force. And they had to just hightail, and they just barely got out. And at some point, Khmelnytsky was at some bar or tavern, and he was gloating. He was to his a bunch of his Cossack friends. This is what I did. Look what I did to that. You know, and some yid overheard it, and went to the noble, and he says, "You remember when you raided the Tartars, and this is what happened, you know? Well, Khmelnytsky was the one they tipped off the Tartars, and that's why they were ready for you." So I don't know if this was the only thing that he did, but at some point they decided to take Khmelnytsky and they put him up in jail, and whatever trial they did, and they decided they were going to kill him. The next day or whatever, they left it in the, I don't know what they were thinking, but they left it in the hands of these Cossacks to do, or the Cossacks offered to do the deed of killing him, and instead of killing him, they took Khmelnytsky and they ran away to the eastern side of the Dnieper River. And when that happened, now already Khmelnytsky decided to get himself an army and to start to do start his raid. So when he started to come in, now this time, you know, the last two raids, the last two rebellions of the Cossacks, I guess they weren't as organized, they weren't as many, and the Poles sent in an army and they were just able to put it down very quickly. But this time they sent the army, they weren't expecting either as many or as organized. And they came, and they came by way, and when they, now one other thing he did, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned this also, is he made a treaty with the Tartars. So now it wasn't, that's also part of why he was much, much better off. It wasn't just himself, the Cossacks, but it was the Cossacks and the Tartars. And they made a deal among themselves in that the Cossacks will get the land and some of the money, and the Tartars would get the animals and get the people. And the people, because again, they're Muslims, and they were going to take the captives, and they were going to sell them as slaves in the Muslim markets. And that was the deal between the two of them was. Now, any Jews that made it to the Tartars were better off. It's sad, but those were the lucky ones. Those that were captured, if you had a choice to go to the Cossacks or the Tartars, you went to the Tartars. Hopefully the Tartars wouldn't kill you or, whatever, do bad things to you, and they would just sell you on the market, and places in the Jews in the Muslim lands would redeem them, which that really did happen for many of them. And there's stories, accounts on hundreds of Jews that were taken, and they were taken in Constantinople and many other cities. They were in fact redeemed by the Jews in Italy and in Constantinople and all through the lands there. Okay. So they came, and the army came, and little did they know they were up against the Poles and the Tartars, and that was it. The first army they sent was surrounded. They killed some of them. Some of the army actually were Cossacks that defected to the Cossacks, and they captured these two generals and the army, and they begged them, "Don't kill us." And they captured them and they kept them as captives. Eventually, sometime later, the Tartars are going to, with the Poles, they're going to make a swap. They're going to be able to, I believe that they gave some of them back. They bought them back or they made whatever trade they did. Okay, and that was the beginning of the, what ended, you see how Hashem runs the world, is when that happened, the day that happened, King Vladislav died. So the King of Poland died. Had he been alive, he would have mobilized the army immediately, and he would have gone ahead and put this rebellion down, or not let it get as much or as far as it did. but he died. And again, now you needed to have an election, and all the Poles, the Polish nobles, they were all vying for their own power. They're not, the more everybody, if everybody's interested in their own, what's in it for me. So things did not work and go as well as it did until, I guess, at some point they realized, we better get a move on this, we better get a king, otherwise we're going to lose everything. But that was the, and that's what happened. So now the Cossacks and the Tartars are basically free to roam around. It says over here just another story. This is all from Ravnasa Nata. He brings down that, again, west, I heard to the city of Poland, I heard to the nine. So all the nobles that were there realized that the Polish army was captured, and that's it. There was nothing between them and the Cossacks and Tartars. So all the nobles that were west of the Dnieper River, again, closer to Poland, they all ran. They ran up to the city of Polonowa. I'll show you where that is soon. And, okay, fine. Then he brings one story of Duke Wisniewski, if I don't know if I'm saying it right. And this Duke was a friend, and what he ended up doing is he took about, I guess, I don't know if it says 500 Jews with him, but instead of going west, he went north into Lithuania. So again, Lithuania is now north of this. Basically, at this time, they are going to be mostly spared of the horrors. The Cossacks are going to go north, but nothing like what's happening over here. And he saved 500 Jews, were basically saved going with this noble up north. This is an area of this was the area of the state that the Cossacks got. This is how far they got. This is where Podolia is, Polonia, that was above. Here is the Dnieper River. They got all the way into to Moldova. They actually entered into Lithuania a little bit, and for a short time. When you see yellow, they had this for a short amount of time. This is Chernia. This is, I guess, where basically it started. And here are the Turks. Okay, and basically they conquered. They went from city to city to city, and this is where they were at the end of a year and a half. So the main part of this is a year and a half of until the Poles were able to stop this and put this and go back on them. This is also another map on showing how far they got in this area. Okay, actually this is a little bit later also, with the Swedes in Russia, but okay, we'll come back to that. Anyway, okay, Polonowa, he says they reached actually Polonowa, Ravnasa Nata brings it, was a big tzaddik in Polonowa, a big Kabbalist, Rishimshin of Astropoli, and he says about Rishimshin, an angel were appearing every day to teach him the mysteries of the Torah. He composed a commentary on the Zohar, and the agent told him prior to the massacre to indulge in sincere repentance. And I guess it wasn't. Now, this is where Polonowa is. It's in Galicia, and this is still in, this is where they captured, they would go till about here. I think it's the Rug or Rug River that they captured till this area. Now, there's a city over here, Nemirov. In that city of Nemirov, they slaughtered 6,000 Jews. And this was really, really at the very, very beginning of their raid. So they were constantly taking city by city. Everybody realized what was happening, and they kept going place to place. Nemirov was a city that actually had some fortifications. It was a bigger city, but they surrounded the city, and eventually they killed the Jews there. There were about 6,000 Jews that were killed. After the war, after the 49, when at least this part of the war was done, so the Vlad Arba Artsos, the Council of the Four Lands, they actually made a fast within Poland for the day of the massacre of Nemirov. But that was like, that was the beginning, that was like the real beginning of massive killings of Jews. Okay? Anyway, this frog in Rav Shimshon of in Palo Noah of Astropo, he told them to do tshuva, but eventually it didn't work. When the Cossacks came, all 300 most prominent citizens, they all wore tachrichim with talisim, and they engaged in fervent prayer, and they all killed them all in the shul. And he just goes on, it's heartbreaking. I'm not going to go through all the stories, but such terrible, sad stories one after another of what happened, how they mercilessly killed Jews, how really, really vicious, painfully, how they killed Jews. This is really the precursor of the Holocaust. If you want to know what was the Holocaust going to look like, it would be this. At the end of it all, they don't even know how many Jews were killed. They believe that there were about 500,000 Jews in Poland at the time. And some people even say that 500,000 Jews died. That's like a very, very high number. Most would say about 100,000. 100,000 to 125,000 Jews either were killed through the war and the plagues and left. So at the end of the war, there was like one third almost of the Jews were left.
What was their motivation? Is it just hatred?
Hatred.
Hatred,
that's it. They had enough of the Poles.
And
money, you know. It doesn't hurt that they get money out of all this. And, at some point, I think that they could have made for themselves a state, you know, they could have. But they, I guess, were too greedy, they were too busy, they were enjoying the killing and, you know, whatever, as opposed to, okay, here we are, and now let's, you know, deal with us, and you know, now we'll make a country a state, but it didn't, never fan that was always involved in wars and fighting. Zaslav. Now, this is Reb Nassim Nachman's story, and he writes in how he was in Zaslav, which was only 6 miles from Palo Noah. And he just writes, and just, you know, they heard that they were very, very, very misinformed. They thought when they were in Zaslav, the situation was much worse than what it was. And what happened is there was an army, Duke Vyshnetsky, we mentioned this, that Duke Vyshnetsky, who helped the Jews go north, he had an army, and he was really waiting for more reinforcements, but they thought that he had left. And they said, oh no, they heard that he had left and he wasn't there, so they all left. And then as they're running with their wagons and whatever they could put on their horses and wagons, their gold, their silver, their spurs, people came behind them and they said, Polono has been captured, all the nobles and Jews were murdered. Now, I don't know if that was so yet, but they started to go to Ostrov, which is a bigger city, which is a little bit, you know, more northeast. And as they're going, people came to them and called out, and they said, what are you going so slowly for? The enemy is almost ready to get you. And when that happened, it was total panic. And then people were just throwing their gold and silver off, and they were running, people running into the forest without their families. It was total panic. People left all of their stuff, you know, just they lost everything. At least they were going slow, but they had whatever they had, they were going with them. But after that, it was just, they were misinformed. They weren't really. And he brings out that that's part of the curse. It says, the curse in the Tophet, it says, you're going to be running, even though they're not chasing you. You know, and this is really what he brings over here. Basically, if you can get past the Vistula River, and this is where they had to get to, so now this is where you'd be safe. Okay? okay, but they, you know, they had to go from here to us from the Polono, and they just had to keep going, and this is what everybody was doing. This was the flight of all the refugees. All the Jews that were here, they kept going east, they kept going west and west and west, and ahead of the Cossacks, ahead of the Tartars. And it just goes on, they finally made it, and he eventually, Massenet eventually made it to Germany. He left, and he didn't come out. And this is what he writes, he says, for all the confusion, panic, everyone threw their furniture from his cart, silver and gold, and they ran for their lives. And they, he brings a posse, they cast everything away, and you shall flee, it's the part of, but none pursues you. That's whatever his story. Okay, the Evangel Missoula writes that there were 700 communities. He writes 700 communities that were devastated, up to more than 700 communities, cities, and resettlements, up to the Vistula River, which we said, which I showed you all over here, which this was the Vistula. So this up to the Vistula, I guess, was all taken over. I guess once you passed the Vistula, you were in safer ground. I guess that was close to Poland, that was close to the ground, to the crown, and there was less issues. Okay. Then what happened came the plague. So with the people running, and I guess less hygiene, and weakened because he didn't have food, and that now that plague started, and the plague came out everywhere. And things were going, it was a sort of a plague with high fever. And now that they went to certain places, so certain cities weren't letting them in because of the plague. And now that added to people dying, and it just added to the confusion, to the pain, to the suffering. Jews became impoverished. The bounds of silver gold garments, which they managed to obtain, they sold for half their value. Silk and other garments, a third. Books were worthless, there were no buyers. Totally deserted, the Gentiles put only silver and gold garments. After the Sukkot of 1649, Polish nobles returned. Okay, so then finally they got themselves a king. They took the king's brother who passed away, and he became the next king. And once he became a king, he gathered an army, a very large army, and they started to fight back. And there were wars back and forth. But by the end of a year and a half, by about Sukkot of 1649, which is about a year and a half later, so they got peace back. And the Polish nobles were able to return to their homes. Also, I guess Jews also started to come back. But this time, out of the destitute and poor, the Ukrainian people, thousands and ten thousands, perished from starvation. The famine for bread was not as great as the lack of money, because the Cossacks and Tartars had robbed everything of all their money and treasures. The Jews, however, as indignant and destitute as they were, in the eyes of the multitude of nobles, they thought the Jews still had money. They were compelled to give the exorbitant taxes. Nothing remained in their hands. Their poverty grew worse from day to day. Nevertheless, they offered praise and thanks to Hashem for the peace which they enjoyed. Again, Masanata, chapter 15. Okay, and this is Nemirov. Okay.
Were the Cossacks just killing Jews or everybody?
Mainly Jews. Nobles too. Polish nobles as well. There was I don't know if I have it here, but there was one city where the nobles and Jews made a deal with each other. Okay, and it was basically the war had just started. The Poles had just started sending armies. I forget the name of the city. Massenata brings it down, and the Poles and the Jews were there together, and they made a pact with one another that we'll deal with all of you. Anyway, the Ukrainians surrounded the city, and basically they said to the nobles, if you give up your Jews, we'll let you survive. And basically the nobles said, okay, that's what we'll do. And they were calling in the Jews one by one. And as they called in the Jews one by one, they kept disarming them, putting them, because the Jews and the nobles together were going to fight the city. And the Jews realized what the Polish nobles were doing. And he says, the Jews had a decision to make: do we fight the Poles or not? So there was a rav there, very far-thinking rav. Again, I don't remember the names. And the rav said to the people, we're not fighting the Poles. So I'll tell you what's going to happen. He said, we're going to fight the Poles here. Then Jews all over the countryside, wherever else, is going to have a... They're going to say, oh, the Jews fought the Poles there. The Jews, it's going to be worse for the Jews elsewhere. We're not going to fight them. We're not going to fight. And sure enough, the Poles sent the Jews out to the Cossacks, and they were basically all killed, or mostly killed. And then they opened the gates or whatever, and then they started to kill the nobles. And the nobles said, "But I thought we had a deal here, right? We gave you the Jews." And the Cossacks laughed at them, and they said, "You know, you broke your thing to the Jews, you know, and so you deserve what you're getting. Like, you know, what good is?" You know, we're just doing to you what you did to the Jews. So, Nasan Nata says, because of that, because they went ahead and killed the nobles, that saved the Jews all over. Because the nobles no longer would ever trust the lying Cossacks. Had the Cossacks allowed the nobles to survive by giving money and Jews, then the nobles, that's what they would have done all over. The Polish people could have just said, here, take the Jews, and that's it. They could have outlived it. But once they did that, everybody realized you can't trust the Cossacks. And that was like a major thing that they realized, this is not okay. So by 1649, they put down the rebellion. The Cossacks were still around. But part of what they did also is they paid off the Tartars. So the Tartars went home, and all that was left were the Cossacks. And there was a certain area that the Cossacks had, and they pushed them back to a certain area. And that's where, in 1649, that's what it was. Now, the war is going to continue, and it's going to take on a lot of different shapes and forms, and different people are going to get involved in the war. But I think this may be a good place to stop. In terms of the Jews that were being killed outright by the Cossacks, this was the worst time of it. And the Jews are going to be caught in wars, but in terms of the amount of Jews being killed just for being Jews in such a short time, on such a large scale, it was during this year and a half. And I guess maybe next time we'll just pick it up with what happens after. So for the next 8 years or so, the wars are going to continue through all parts of Poland with different players, people switching different sides. All right, any questions?
Where's Chalniki at this point?
Where is who? Oh, Chalniki is going to die on his bed. He's going to die a natural death. Okay, and he's not going to be killed in war.
Okay.
But he has his little Cossack area state. But things are going to change. Things are going to change. Right now, he has some sort of a treaty that they made. Nobody's happy with this treaty, and it's just going to lead to more violence. Mr. Hashem. We'll pick it up.
Does Poland stay united with Lithuania? Or
Yeah, sure.
But Ukraine is completely separate.
Ukraine, that area, right. As you saw in, this is what the map looks like now. Nope. Yeah. This is what the map looks like now. So here are the Tartars, here's Russia, Moldavia, Ottomans, right? And this is the area that they have, all the way till about Lithuania, and all about, I believe this is about where the Bug, the Rug River is.
Okay.
Okay, and this is what they have now, and they're, I guess, the Polish army is somewhat there, so, right, but things are going to change, and they're